The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
On today's show, we're going to answer several more Social Security and IRA questions. I believe we've got a few of each of those. I know we have Social Security questions because there's a never-ending supply of Social Security questions. We've come to realize there's a whole bunch of Social Security questions out there, which is one reason why we have a dedicated blog that handles Social Security topics. We certainly cover them on our broader Q&A show here. That you're listening to right now, obviously, but we also have a dedicated blog at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com that is focused entirely on Social Security. We answer a lot of questions, we cover a lot of topics of interest, and there's an archive of lots of information about Social Security on that site. So in addition to this resource where we've got kind of our broader show where we cover all things retirement related, which would obviously include Social Security issues, we've got this dedicated site as well. I just wanted to remind people that that is there. Welcome. My name is Chris. I'm here with Jim, as usual, on Monday afternoon, Mountain Time. Phone lines are open, so if you would like to call in, 970-530-0556 is the phone number. That is on about 3 p.m. Mountain Time on today is Monday, October 29th. That's when we're recording this. If you're listening after that, obviously phone lines aren't open at that time. If you've got questions, you can certainly send them to us, as most people do, through email versus calling in. That's best way to contact us that way would be jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And you'll find a contact form on there, pretty easy to find. You can submit your questions, and we'll put them in the queue, if you will, and get to them eventually. Some we get to faster than others, but calling in is always the most expeditious way of getting your question answered, because we can go through it right there live on the show with you. So if you'd like to prearrange that with us, just call 970-530-0556 and we can get you set up with Laura so that she can put you on the show as soon as it starts. We don't have a live caller yet today, so we'll dive right into email questions, I believe.
Just remember, pretty much every Monday between 2:30 and 3 Mountain Time is when we do the recording. So if you are planning a live call to get your question answered right away, adjust it for whatever time zone you're in. But again, between 2:30 and 3 p.m. Mountain Time, if you call to the office, 970-530-0556, during that time frame, Laura will queue you up. let us know that we have a caller on the phone. We'll bring you on in the middle of recording, and boom, we can answer your question.
Perfect.
Sound good? Mm-hmm. Okay. A couple of housekeeping items that I want to update. One thing, since you are the official soundboard man, do you have the clap sound effect?
I do.
Well, can we clap for the Boston Red Sox winning the Super Bowl? Not Super Bowl. What the hell did they win?
World Series.
World Series. Yes, mm-hmm. I knew that. I get confused with New England Patriots always winning the Super Bowl, although they didn't
always
last year.
Always isn't really the right word, but...
They go to it an awful lot. They don't always
win it.
They
visit.
They visit the
Sometimes
Super Bowl.
Sometimes as spectators, even.
But I do want to give a big kudos to the Boston Red Sox, clinching and winning the Super...
World Series.
Thank you. Yesterday... It was a good game. Did you watch? Well, it was a good game if you are a Red Sox fan. Not so much if you are a Dodgers fan.
True.
But anyways, do want to give a little kudos and a shout out to them. Also want to bring our listeners up to date. I was attending the Ed Slott training last week from Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of last week. And did a lot of IRA studies as we always do. And I have some wonderful, wonderful topics for EDU shows. Five or six different IRA topics that we're going to dive into. Ed was on fire diving into some pretty deep topics on IRAs that we will get into on future shows. And we also got our first, I don't think we're going to get to it this week. Maybe we will. I haven't decided yet. Our first specific email for an EDU show.
I saw that one come through.
Yeah, he said, for your EDU topic. I thought that was a good one. So if anybody has a topic they want us to dive deep into, that's what the EDU show is. On this Q&A show that we're going to do, the Q&A show is very cursory. We just do a light review, especially me. You know, I can be very pithy and to the point. Chris kind of yaps and goes on and on. But we intend to try to get as many emails as we can. I think last week we got, six or seven?
It was a record. Knocked out a few.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was a record last week. So I do want to encourage people, we will not take phone calls on an EDU show. We don't even record live at that point. But if you have something you want us to dive deep into, this man sent us a very long email for our EDU show. We would be more than happy to entertain topics that we think might be of interest to all our listeners. And then finally, about our blog post that Chris talked about, the helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. I am pleased to say we have begun a major overhaul of our blog sites. And Joe is our new marketing girl. I don't want to say new. Joe's been working with me for years. She kind of took a little hiatus when she went back to CSU for her studies in dietitian. Is that what you call it? Health, nutrition, whatever she studied. She's a dietitian.
Yeah.
Okay. Joe is back as she grows her dietitian practice, and she's back doing what Julia was doing, since Julia has taken a job traveling around the world digging up grave sites of World War II veterans. Mm-hmm. And she couldn't pass up that phenomenal job. So we have some great ideas that we're going to be doing on our podcast. Excuse me, not a podcast, but on our blog site and to a degree on the radio show's website. So Joe has a lot of ideas. You're going to see some big changes on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and, of course, the blog's website, which is the retirementandiraShow.com. Both of those sites are going to get major, major overhauls. If it moves with the speed and efficiency that it usually does, anything marketing related in this office, I would say by this time next year, we'll be almost ready to start. Well, things take forever. It moves like wet molasses on a cold. Is that cold molasses on a wet day or wet molasses on a cold day or something like that? It doesn't move very fast. Does not move with the speed that the molasses moved during the great molasses thing of 1917.
Disaster
in Boston.
Must have been the heat of the summer because of the way it flowed.
Yeah, I can't believe you never heard of that either.
Well, I heard of it years ago.
Yeah,
from you.
This show,
exactly.
Okay, so that was the only housekeeping items that I wanted to clear up. We're going to jump into email questions, and I hope to get through as many as I can. This first one will be a Social Security question from a listener in the fine state of Texas.
Nice.
Okay. It begins, I need to repay my Social Security benefits. I filed in September of 2017 and withdrew my benefits September of 2018. I'm going to have you, as part of this answer, Chris, explain how withdrawal of benefits work. Suffice to say, this person cut it real close.
Real.
And I'll let you explain that. I received a letter from Social Security saying I need to repay a certain amount, but there was no due date on the letter. And no one at Social Security seems to know the answer to when this payment is due. And they wrote to us for more clarification. Can you answer the question of when the payment is due, but also maybe explain to our listeners how repaying benefits work and why someone may want to repay benefits?
Sure. So first of all, I will have to admit that when we received this question, I had to go look it up. This is a very specific question about a procedural step at Social Security. So I remember a lot of things, fewer things than I did when I was younger. But this is one I never had to identify specifically before. So I can't answer it. I will answer it here momentarily after I first describe what they're talking about, because some people might be saying, wait a minute, repay your Social Security benefits. What the heck? Well, you might have to do that if you would like to process what's called a withdrawal of your benefit application. Believe it or not, Social Security has a provision that allows you to do a do-over, essentially. You go to them and say, I made a mistake or I changed my mind. I'd like to not suspend what I have. That's one act. But instead, I'd rather completely withdraw my application and go back to as if I had never approached you to claim any benefits. I want to undo my application for benefits. The Social Security system allows you to do so with a few requirements. First, you're only allowed to make this request once in a lifetime. So this is a one-time do-over. You can't do this repeatedly. So a one-time do-over. Secondly, you must process the withdrawal for application within 12 months of your initial application for benefits. So you have 1 year, and that's where your comment came in. Applied
cutting
in September,
close.
And then in September the following year, you cut it very, very close. I would recommend not cutting it quite that close, but she got in right under the wire, right at the 12-month mark. The third requirement, which is what is the topic of her email, is that you must repay all benefits that were paid on your record to include your own benefit as well as any auxiliary benefits, say spousal benefits or dependent benefits that were paid on your record over that year in her case, to complete the withdrawal. So it's a complete do-over. You give all the money back that they paid you and say, forget it, I withdraw, I'm going to claim at a later date. Why you might do this is that your situation has changed. You've decided that you'd rather delay claiming so you can claim a higher amount later. Maybe your employment situation changed. Maybe you just made a mistake. You look back and you think, I should have done this a different way. They allow you to do this do-over. So she's completed most of those steps. She applied and was approved. So she met the 12-month. She's only done it once. She wants to repay, and this is what you do. You don't try to predict what they pay. You submit the application for withdrawal of benefits, and they will then calculate how much you want or how much you must repay, and they will send you a letter, which she admits receiving. To complete the withdrawal, you must pay fill in the blank. We don't know what her amount was. But she wants to know, when do I have to pay this? There's actually a very specific answer in the POMS, the Program Operations Manual, which tells the Social Security people how to handle all these detailed steps. What they do is they send you this letter. It does not have a due date on it, but they put in their file a reminder to call you or contact you in 30 days. They will then contact you in 30 days if you haven't paid and say, are you sure? Are you still going to move forward with this? You have 15 more days to finish this, or we're going to deny the withdrawal application and we'll pretend like you never even sent us this. We'll continue. We'll fire your benefits back up and move on. So the answer is 45 days. You have a total of 45 days. They're going to remind you after 30 that they haven't received anything, and at that point warn you that you only have 15 more days. But for some strange reason, on the letter they send you, it doesn't say must be paid within fill in the blank.
Well, that's not strange.
They set it up to remind you if they don't receive it. So it's kind of the assumption is it's due on receipt. You need to, this is your deal. You requested this. Here's the amount. Send the check now. If you don't make it within the 45 days, they're going to deny the application, and the only way to reopen it is to appeal that and explain for whatever reason that you didn't know or didn't receive the reminders or something like that and hope that they provide forgiveness.
Well, I would say again, as I started to, I don't find it strange. I find it very typical of the inefficiencies of a government bureaucracy. They're going to send you a letter, and nowhere in that letter does it indicate this is a bill.
And I haven't seen the letter, so I'm just taking her word for it that it didn't say in the letter the due date on there. Honestly, I have not seen recently a letter requesting this. A few years ago, I saw one from somebody. They shared it with me, but I kind of glanced it over. I didn't dissect it looking for the due date. They had the money set aside ready to pay back, so it wasn't a question for them.
Yeah, but I can understand their question because, according to the listener, it wasn't an invoice. It was just, hey, you owe this much. Oh, okay. Yep. And I'd have done the same thing. I would have, okay, send me a bill. And then they're going to get a hold of you 30 days later when you got 15 days left to get the money to them. Oh, by the way, that was the bill, and you best get this out to us in 15 more days.
I'm under the understanding there's an envelope included in that letter.
Now, if there's an envelope, but still, if there's no, I'd still wait for an organized invoice. I would just look for an organized invoice.
I don't believe something that looks like an invoice. It's more of a letter. This is how much you owe. Send it in, and we'll complete your withdrawal application.
And that's just very typical of government bureaucracies. Yeah. But anyways, hopefully we helped that listener with that answer, and we hoped that helped our other listeners, that you can get a one-time do-over. And the biggest time, we've done several of these. We've helped people do these do-overs, as you know, Chris. And every time it was for a simple reason. The people realized they claimed too early. They overlooked the true benefit of Social Security, which is a longevity product. They weren't factoring in delayed retirement credits most of the time and realizing how much they could get, looking at their life expectancy and the amount of money they can get from Social Security as opposed to trying to live off of investments or a private annuity sale, realizing Social Security is not that bad of a deal. I wish I would have waited. And that's when they find they may want to repay them. Or totally muffing up maybe some people who were still grandfathered under the old rules, making a mistake on a filing and realizing there were some claiming strategies they could have done and wishing that they had a do-over.
Yeah. And believe it or not, there didn't used to be the 12-year rule. You used to be able to withdraw your application even after receiving benefits. I'm sorry, 12-month rule, yes.
At any time,
as long as you could scrape together the money to pay back all the benefits they paid you, which of course could be an enormous amount if you waited 5, 6, 7 years before claiming. So they wanted to remove that from the opportunities that you might have and say, okay, here's your deadline. You've got to do it within 12 months, which it appears she did. If she hadn't made it under the wire, they would have sent her a letter saying, sorry, you missed it. But the fact that they sent her a letter saying this is what you owe to complete the withdrawal means she met all the other criteria. And as long as she pays that, she's good to go.
Perfect. Okay, we've got another Social Security question.
Okay.
I have a Social Security account online. And this, by the way, is from a listener from the fine state of Michigan.
Oh, moving north finally.
Moving north.
I have a lot of southern questions.
We have a lot of southern questions. But this one is from the fine state of Michigan, which, last time I checked, can be a very cold state in the wintertime.
Can be.
I have a Social Security account online, but I cannot access it. They have verified, I would assume Social Security, they have verified I am using my correct username, but every time I try to find out if I'm using my correct password, I get a message that they cannot identify my personal information. I try calling their help desk, but I'm always waiting an hour on the phone. And I guess they get fed up with it and they hang up after said hour because they ask, is there an easier way for me to resolve this? Thank you. And unfortunately, in 10 words or less, I think the answer is no, but there, I'll let you answer it.
There's one thing you can try first, and it may or may not apply. They verify your identity through some questions that only you should know the answer to. And they're questions that they can verify the answer to via your credit report. So if you have your credit report frozen and locked down so they cannot access it, that can create this issue. I'm not saying it is the issue here, but that can create it. So if you realize, oh, yeah, I've got my credit report frozen, you can temporarily unfreeze it to do the password reset process. They usually only have, they don't do this every time you log in. It's only if you do something like set up the account for the first time or you request a password reset. They want to make sure it's actually you. So they take these extra steps, asking you questions about, you know, what was the last mortgage payment you made, roughly an amount. You know, do you have a loan with one of these five folks?
Have you purchased one of these cars in the last 5 years?
Yeah. So they use public records. And if for some reason they can't verify those records, that process will fail. And you may have to go into, ultimately, it might be shorter and more effective to go into your local office, make an appointment at your local office, and bring identification, passports, legal documents, driver's license, things like that, with you to prove your identity. And then they can start the password reset process for you, is my understanding. So there is an alternative. But if you have your credit report locked, that may or may not be causing the issue and is something easy to do for most people, and you can try that. So I'd attempt that. We hear this most of all from people who are trying to set up an account for the first time. But the same security protocols kick in when you try to do a password reset as well. So
okay,
that's my advice.
And continuing with our trend of Southern email questions, mm-hmm. Now we're going to travel to the fine state of Florida.
Oh. Nice.
And another Social Security question.
Excellent.
And then we have a bunch of non-Social Security questions.
Okay.
So those iTunians who are getting fed up with Social Security questions, we've got non-ones coming after this. This one,
these
as you can
see, good ones,
is a
actually.
Real short one.
These are different.
Different?
These have been unique.
And this one's different and unique.
Oh,
even
nice.
More so.
Okay.
I applied for my Social Security card on September 6, 2018. I have not received my Social Security card yet. And this was sent October 2nd. Any remarks you want to give? That was it. That was the whole point. That's it for the question. So I'm assuming they're wondering, is a month wait enough? By the time they get their answer, it's been 2 months. But what would your answer be to this person and to anyone else who applied for their Social Security card? Do you have any idea what a reasonable wait time is?
I have not heard, but with dealings with Social Security in general, I am not shocked a month has passed without receiving something you were expecting from them. I would say it would be reasonable to assume between 1 month and 2 months. So during the month of October, this person should have received it, and if not, they need to contact the Social Security Administration either by making an appointment or calling their customer service number in order to find out if they actually sent it, if there was something that held it up. If they sent it, I'd be a little worried that it was intercepted in the mail, and they'd be subject to, I'd watch out really closely for identity theft issues. Some people in that business, if you will, if you want to call it a business of identity theft, would love to get their hands on an actual Social Security card from a person. So they're probably targeted and watched for by those who rifle through people's mail and look for that sort of stuff. So I don't know their situation. I'm not saying this did happen, but I wouldn't panic at a month, but I'd find it really extraordinary for it to be past 2 months that a person would receive this. But I will see if maybe for next time I can look into what's the typical promised delivery time on those. But I'm not surprised at a month they haven't gotten anything.
Okay.
Most of what I've seen, 5-6 weeks is when you start to get responses on things. It's almost like they're on a monthly cycle. So the questions from 1 month get answered by about the middle of the next month, kind of a situation. So.
Yeah, I thought when we got this email, and if someone is wondering, what do you mean they applied for Social Security card? I'm just purely making a broad-based assumption here, listeners. Based on the name, this person looks like a new immigrant to this nation, working at a university in Florida. So I'm just guessing someone's coming in, working at a university, pulling a Social Security card, foreigner, coming on board, working here. Hence why an adult is trying to get a Social Security card.
Mm-hmm. Or it could be a replacement. But they didn't. Usually someone will say, I've applied for a replacement card.
Right.
So it is probably someone who's, for the first time, requesting a number. And they go through a process of verification and things. So it takes a little time.
Speed and efficiency of government.
Yeah.
To a new listener from another country. I can guess what country this is, but I'm not going to on the podcast. But I do want to welcome them to America with open arms and hope your stay working at a university down in Florida goes well. And I hope you get your Social Security card.
Yeah, hopefully they've got it already.
Yeah, by the time we answer this, a month after the email came in. But this email we're going to answer next. We're going to jump in line here. I can't really say in line because this email came in several weeks ago. But upon closer examination, I probably should have answered this email right away. And if you have the little clap sound effect, you'll see in a minute why we are going to clap.
Okay.
So it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris."
Too soon?
We don't have to clap over Jim and Chris, although they finally said your name.
Oh, that's true. So that deserves a clap. Thanks.
you were finally acknowledged. You had it last
so
week,
nice.
And
I know,
you
I
were
got,
taking it
I was,
seriously.
I was
acknowledged
several
Laura
times
was.
Last week. Yes.
Laura's our admin, and she got acknowledged in an email, and she hasn't even been on the show ever.
Wow.
Hi, Jim and Chris. I'm a new listener to your show and have learned a great deal of information. I am hoping to gain some insight and gather your opinion on a particular situation with a defined pension plan, defined benefit pension plan.
Okay.
And then they go on to say, I was a teacher in Kentucky.
Oh, that's the clapping?
That's the clap
sound. Oh, okay. So hopefully contained in this email is
a Kentuckian.
Some feedback as to your question about Kentucky.
Never. Nope.
Oh,
negative.
Okay,
rather.
Well, then there's no... There, we're
I shouldn't be answering this because there was no mention of Kentucky.
There should only be clapping if someone finally shows up in the email box.
Actually,
to letting you know if you should
retire.
There
was a listener. I totally forgot. I want to thank that listener. A Kentuckian wrote and told. I acknowledged this on the show.
I thought there was a person they were.
Yes, and
but
they said because of all the trees that there's a lot of humidity in Kentucky. I talked about that.
Oh, there's a lot, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they acknowledge that it's pretty damn humid.
Like you can cut the air with a knife. It's
for 3 months, and that's it. And then
three
it's
months?
That's it, yes.
Oh, come
according
on.
To Wikipedia weather, Kentucky does not have any extreme seasons.
So I shouldn't have gone there in the third week of July when
no.
I visited?
No, July and August, okay. According to Wikipedia weather, stay away.
So I visited. When I visited there, it was the middle of July.
Yeah, no, and, it's pretty brutal.
And the locals were complaining it was so hot. So I understand I probably timed it very poorly.
Yes.
But it was enough to turn me off from visiting.
Well, I'm thinking maybe in the summer I exit Kentucky every now and then.
Because I'm not built to handle that. I drew up in the dry, parched west of the United States in a very arid climate, essentially. We have a false sense of moisture here because we've planted all these trees, made it look all pretty. That's not the natural state for this area. And so my skin has adapted to the lizard-like outer coating required for a dry climate. It does not fare well in the presence of humidity.
No, it does not, and neither does gardening, and that's why I'm going to move to Kentucky. Okay, I was a teacher in Kentucky for 9 years,
okay,
where I am now vested in a defined benefit pension plan with the teacher's retirement system.
Mm-hmm.
I have now moved to Ohio. Wonder why you moved to Ohio from Kentucky?
It's not far. No,
no, it's just over the river.
Trip. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not far. And I am teaching here. Oh, well, that's why maybe you got a better job.
Yeah.
And paying into their pension system.
Mm-hmm.
The two states are not reciprocal with their retirement program.
Mm.
Currently, I have a balance of $46,000 in the Kentucky Retirement Program. If I was to leave this sit, I would receive at age 60 an annuity of around $650 to $700 a month. My question is, since I'm only 34 years old, would I be better off rolling this money into a traditional IRA? And then he gets into what he wants to buy in the IRA. I don't want to get into that. Kentucky has been having funding issues for their retirement plans, which is one reason I'm considering this option. The other reason is I wonder if I could possibly beat what the Kentucky plan is going to offer. This is an interesting email because the money is going to sit there for almost 30 years. It'll sit for 26 years. Yeah. And one thing this listener didn't tell us is the $650 to $700 a month he is going to receive in today's dollars, and they're going to increase it for inflation. So in other words, the nominal money that he may be receiving in the future will be higher than $650 to $700, but the buying power will be the equivalent of $650 to $700 today. Or is Kentucky saying, hey, keep your $46,000 in, and in 26 years, we're going to give you $650 to $700. Because in 26, let's just call it 30 years. In 30 years, Chris, $700 a month ain't going to be that much.
No, be worth the equivalent of half or less of that, most likely.
Less.
Half, yeah.
So when I read his email, I don't have that answer. He didn't delve into that aspect of the Kentucky system. I will say the Kentucky system, you know how Pew Research rates state pension plans, they really gave the Kentucky system a low grade this year. I mean, we're talking Kentucky is on par with Illinois, Connecticut, and California. Really poor retirement systems. And I don't mean to throw Connecticut under the bus. That might not be one of them that was listed in Pew. But Illinois usually always rises to the top of pension systems to avoid. And as someone who wants to relocate to the state of Kentucky, that did concern me because the taxpayers of the state will be the ones most likely bailing out the Kentucky program if it runs into problems in the future. And if I ever did relocate there in another 10, 15 years when I retire, I may be forced to bail out the Kentucky program.
So I think it's hard to give without substantial additional information, give them specific advice, but we can talk about how a person would assess this situation.
Exactly.
Because this is a question that certainly comes up regularly.
All the time.
Especially with the mobility of people moving from job to job, from school district to school district. It just happens so much more often than it did 30 years ago. People have these little bits of pensions at multiple places. And the question is always, gee, should I leave it there or should I cash out?
Well, let me answer my opinion,
okay,
and then you answer with your opinion.
Sounds good.
Okay. My thought would be this. You need to first, listener, find out, is this $650 to $700 in today's dollars, or is it going to be in nominal or real dollars, I guess is what I'm getting at. So in 26 years when you turn 60, are they going to give you just $650? No matter what $650 is worth in 26 years, that's what you're getting. Or is it what you would get and they're going to increase it for inflation, so maybe you're getting $1,500 in the future, which gives you the buying power of $650 today. If you were going to get I don't have my calculator with me, Chris, but do a quick calculation. If someone was getting $650 today, that's $650 times 12 divided by 46,000, how many years before it quote-unquote breaks even?
Well, it's about a 17% payout. So,
which is damn good.
Yeah, that's, but there's 26 years of growth, in air quotes.
No. What I'm saying is if today, if he was 60 today and they were giving him $650.
That would be an easy question to answer. Take the annuity.
Take the annuity. My point, listener, is if they're going, my personal opinion, if they're going to increase the $650 for inflation, no matter what inflation may be, you have to look at what the COLA adjustments are. Will it be equal to COLA, cost of living adjustments, or is it capped? Well, it's going to be whatever the inflationary rate is. Up to a certain max, like in the state of Colorado, they have been reducing that on their teachers' pension. Today, the maximum increase that the teachers in Colorado will get is 2% a year. You need to look at what the COLA adjustment, the cost of living adjustment, if any, will be to the $650 to $700. If it's not that meaningful, if they cap it at a very low rate, or if it's zero, or capped at 1% or 2%, you might not want to carry that risk for 26 years. A strong argument could be made to take $46,000 today, put it in an IRA, invest it in low-cost, low-fee, well-diversified holdings, and slowly begin converting that. You're only 34 years old. You are in a low tax bracket right now, relatively speaking, compared to where you'll probably be in your 50s. For most people, their 50s represent peak earnings in their lives. And then as they enter their 60s, for a lot of people, your earnings start going down as you enter retirement. So I think you may be able to convert a lot of that $46,000 into a Roth IRA at rather low tax rates. You're going to get 26 years of growth. You're going to be able to remove all future tax burden. And then you might be able to generate an income stream that on a tax-adjusted basis could easily exceed what $650 to $700 in the future will be, subject to taxes. Remember, that pension is always going to be subject to taxes. Now, if you were a year or two away from retirement and you had $46,000 in there and they were going to be giving you a 17% payout, I think Chris would agree, even if he disagrees with my advice, I think he would agree in that case it's a no-brainer. You take the annuity. But with 26 years to go, the ability to convert to a Roth, the ability to remove future tax risk on that money, the ability to get 26 years of growth inside that Roth. You are also paying into a pension in Ohio, so it's not like you're not in any type of pension program. You're still going to be in one. I think a strong case could be made because of all those reasons, Chris. I would entertain taking a lump sum distribution. But Chris and I really do like pensions, so we're torn. But Kentucky has a weakened pension program. You're going to be exposed to the risk of the Kentucky plan. You're not going to be receiving an income benefit, so you will be subject to any legislative changes, especially the COLA adjustments that they make between now and retirement. Courts have ruled consistently those COLA adjustments are not protected. Only when you begin receiving your pension is it protected. So you're going to be carrying a lot of risk of an underfunded Kentucky plan. So I think because of the weakened Kentucky plan, your young age, the fact that you're not at peak earnings, and the fact that you might be able to do some select Roth conversions, get that money into a Roth, remove tax risk, and have some good growth potential in it, a very strong case could be made to take the lump sum and try doing all of that with it. That would be my take. And what is yours?
I think the main, especially when you're looking at a pension plan that is troubled, that's not strongly funded currently, people might ask, well, why does that happen? It's very simple math. The promised outflows are bigger than the inflows can support. So there's two ways to fix a pension. increase those contributions from either the employee or employer or both, which in these plans are the state, right, and then employees themselves.
Taxpayers, I want to point out to you Kentuckians, because you as a taxpayer are paying the salary that go to the teachers, and you as a taxpayer are also paying the taxes that fund the school system. So when the employer or the employee have an increase, it's really sticking it to the taxpayers. Okay. Just want to point that out. Money doesn't grow on trees. It comes from taxpayers.
No. But these folks are working for a job for which they're being paid, and they're, some of that is being contributed to the plan. So
by taxpayers.
This is a conversation for another show, but that's a very right-wing radio-ish of you, Jim.
Hey.
So the point is contributions are one dial. The benefits being paid are another dial, and they're out of balance when a pension is weakened and in trouble. So people who are close to retirement are generally protected from alterations of this promise that has been made. But people as far away as you are, being only 34, are in the category of, oh, they have plenty of time to alter their retirement plans. So as we adjust these knobs here, which are, in most states I'm seeing, they adjust both of them. They adjust the benefit formula downward, and they turn up the contributions as a way to kind of balance it out on both sides. So it's not just all one or all the other. And so I think the likelihood in a weakened pension plan, state-run pension plan, that your dial, your benefits dial, is susceptible to being turned down. And that's what Jim was talking about with the risk of something going on with the pension plan. Now, is it going to fail completely? I think the likelihood of that on state-supported plans is practically zero, because that's just too drastic. There's always going to be something there. So there's going to be an adjustment, though, almost for sure, in practically all of these plans that have turned out to use overly optimistic returns or investment returns assumptions. They're finding that their formula is out of whack. So the likelihood of that $650 to $700 a month estimate that they're giving you actually being less than that is pretty substantial. The younger you are, the greater that risk. So there's a pretty significant amount of uncertainty there. And so if you were much closer to retirement, I would say you're less susceptible to be affected by that, although there's some of that risk, but not nearly as much as when you're in your 30s. Because of that, my pendulum is going to swing towards looking at taking it out and doing something else with it. We do like pensions, especially those that have a very aggressive benefit formula, because you can't replicate that same amount of income with the lump sum amount in the open marketplace, in the private marketplace.
The very reason we love pensions is the very reason pensions have problems. Failed.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's just, so in the short term, we enjoy it as folks who are heading into retirement and having these very attractive looking benefit formulas that they're paying out. But the reality is that dial is going to slowly turn. It has to. And because they aren't going, it isn't going to be acceptable for them to keep the dial turned up and have the pension outright fail. So the good news is these problems fester for long periods of time. So these adjustments happen over long periods of time, and many people will not live long enough to see the dial turned a whole lot on them if they're already in retirement. A 30-something, though, I think they're very susceptible to this. So I'd be very nervous about a plan. I'm nervous about plans that even aren't in trouble yet. But those who are already in trouble make me especially nervous. So I would be looking at, similar to what Jim said, young age, get the money out, do some attractive tax procedures, meaning take advantage of low tax rates currently, get that money into a tax-free situation, convert it into Roths over time, maybe in stages, a little bit every year kind of thing. Doesn't have to be all or nothing. We've talked about that before on other shows. And the likelihood of you ending up in a better place, especially if now you've got a new pension, you maybe don't want to have all of your retirement resources pensionized inside of a pension. Maybe you would like to have some liquid lump sum assets that you've got. They didn't explain anything else they have. They just said, we went from one defined benefit plan to another one. A lot of people end up with only pension income. We call them asset poor, pension rich, which unfortunately the pension rich part is susceptible to being less rich as time goes by and they fix these out of whack pension formulas. So I think it's a pretty decent idea to consider what Jim mentioned as well. Although for this specific person, we don't have enough details to give a specific recommendation for them. But that's how, if you're thinking about, if you're wanting to know how to think about this, those are the factors to consider. Don't assume that the promise will be there unaltered some, 30 years from now. That's not likely. And it's not going to be better than it is today. These pensions aren't overfunded. They're lucky to be at funding or and almost always somewhat below that amount. So, I think my thought process is generally right in line with yours on this one, Jim.
Okay. Well, hopefully that listener found that a little bit beneficial. He has some more soul searching to do and number crunching to do, and we'll go from there. And one of the things I do want to point out, why Chris and I said if he was older, we'd be less inclined to make this recommendation. Courts have consistently ruled once you are receiving the pension benefit, it is nearly impossible for the employer to actually cut them. But prior to receiving them, all bets are off, and especially COLA adjustments. Mm-hmm. Courts have consistently said, not protected, even if you are receiving.
Right.
But what they're going to do is, let's just say his benefit is $700 a month, and he was receiving it. They're not going to say, well, we can't afford this. We're only going to pay you half that, $350 a month. Nope, can't do it. Now, before he retires, they could change the rules, mm-hmm. change the benefit
not just on
schedule.
Them. They have to change the rules for everyone.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But once you are receiving the pension benefit, courts have protected them. Keep in mind also that government pensions are not ERISA protected, though. So just because courts have consistently ruled that they are protected, doesn't mean that they're going to consistently rule that way in the future if there's ever an economic issue, an economic strife that really, especially a debt, I think it'll be a debt crisis of this nation, that could come back and rear its ugly head. Government pensions are exempt from ERISA rules. ERISA is what prevents private pensions from doing funky things, but government pensions do not have ERISA protection. Okay. On to a non-Social Security question. How much time do we have left?
We're doing pretty well. We're at 48 minutes, so we've got time for at least one more question.
A couple more questions. Mm-hmm. This comes from the fine state, still sticking in the South, Louisiana.
I see.
He signed,
it's like we're stuck east of the Mississippi on all these.
It's signed,
except for Texas. I guess we had Texas.
Bio George. Do we have a sound effect?
No, we don't. Not sure that's...
That's Louisiana.
It is.
Didn't you watch Deliverance?
Was that Louisiana? I thought that was farther north from there.
I thought Deliverance was set in Louisiana.
I am not a close enough follower of Deliverance. I've seen it, but I'm not passionate about it. I haven't studied all the details.
I think it was set in Louisiana.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
Okay.
Good morning, Jim and Chris. I recently found your podcast and have been enjoying them during my commute in Louisiana. This year, my wife and I will be over the threshold to contribute to our Roth IRAs. Mm. And we are planning on doing the backdoor conversions of our non-deductible IRAs. I want to point out to the listener, it's not a backdoor conversion. Anyone can convert. It's a backdoor contribution. Just kind of little thorn in Chris and I's side. It's a backdoor contribution. Doing a backdoor contribution of our non-deductible IRAs that we recently set up and funded. Neither of us have any other pre-tax IRAs, so I believe we are good with the pro rata rule. But my question is, do I need to set up separate Roth IRAs for every conversion? Or can we just do each conversion into our existing Roth IRAs? It seems like there may be a reason. Maybe when recharacterizations used to be allowed where you would keep things separate, but I am not sure now. Appreciate any feedback, Bayou, George.
That was very perceptive, the last comment that they made in that question.
Absolutely.
About recharacterizations and why in the past we recommended exactly what he described.
Because it was my jingle.
Right.
If you mingle, you mangle.
Yep. But sad that that's going away.
Answer his question because you hit the nail on the head, as did he.
Yeah, so we used to recommend you convert into its own standalone Roth until you've surpassed the date for a recharacterization, just to leave it potentially out there as an option cleanly to recharacterize or undo the conversion. And it just made people's lives much easier. And then once you went past the date when you could do that, you move it into your main Roth IRA. That was the typical strategy in the past. But now, since we have now passed the point of where you can do recharacterizations.
Nobody can do them.
Correct. That ship
gone
has sailed.
Gone the way of the dodo bird.
Yep, that is gone. The need for converting into a standalone Roth, I'm trying to think of another reason why, but I can't, is gone. You just convert it. No reason to set up a separate Roth. Just put it in your main Roth because that's a one-way trip. That thing is going in there. You're not getting it back out. You cannot undo it. You're committed once you do the conversion, which isn't necessarily bad. You just have to be more careful in calculating what you're comfortable converting and what you'd like to convert. It's just going to take a little more effort on your or your tax preparer's or financial planner's part to do this comfortably, if you will. But once it's in there, it's in there. So I would say no, the requirements or suggestion that we had of you converting into a new standalone Roth doesn't even have to be new, just a standalone Roth that's not contaminated with any other monies. That's gone. Don't have to worry about that anymore. If you listen to some of our older podcasts from a while back, we'll be making that recommendation. But that was under the old rules where recharacterization was allowed. That's gone.
And why don't you real quickly explain to our listeners what he was talking about? He doesn't have any existing deductible IRA, so the pro rata rule isn't going to apply. For those listeners who might be new, such as him, and don't quite understand the backdoor Roth contribution scenario he's talking about. And before you answer that, I do want to point out to our listeners, the IRS has officially sanctioned and supported this strategy. We talked about this on the podcast. Under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they specifically came out and have said unequivocally what is known as the backdoor Roth contribution is a legitimate planning strategy.
Which is a little surprising in that, if that's true, why don't they just stop forcing us to jump through hoops and just allow people of any income level
to put money
to contribute directly into a Roth?
Right, I agree. And that's not the IRS's fault. That's Congress's
fault. Correct.
IRS just interprets the law. Congress just hasn't.
Congress, once again, is making our lives more difficult than it needs to be because of these rules that have been band-aided year after year after year, creating these complications. So the issue is that over certain income levels for married couples, I believe it's about $190,000 currently. It's roughly that. I don't memorize these numbers, but about $190,000, you're not allowed to contribute to a Roth. Is that true? Is that the 190-ish? Isn't that the number, Jim? He's not paying attention.
No, I wasn't paying attention. I was reading
the Roth phase out for a married couple, 190-ish.
I think it begins around there, yeah.
Yeah, so it's right in that range anyway. So there is a threshold where if you make too much, you're not allowed to contribute to a Roth. And you may or may not want to at that income level because of your tax situation, but they take that choice off your plate. You're not allowed if you have income exceeding that limit. And so, however, there's no income restrictions anymore for doing a conversion from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA. That's allowed. You can also, at any income level, make non-deductible contributions to your traditional IRA. And all that's the earnings limit applies just to deducting the contributions to a traditional IRA. So this sets up the following opportunity. If you have a traditional IRA and you place into it non-deductible money, you haven't taken a tax deduction for it, you've paid the taxes on the money, put it in the traditional IRA, which you're allowed to do at any income level, then turn around and convert it to your Roth. Since you have paid the taxes on it already, there's no additional taxes owed for the conversion to the Roth, and you have effectively made a contribution into your Roth IRA when you thought you may not have been able to because of these earnings limits. That's, in essence, the back door, Roth contribution. The complication, or what you have to watch out for, is if you have deductible and non-deductible money in your traditional IRA, the rules of distributions or extractions, if you will, from your traditional IRA are such that you must prorate between pre- and post-tax money any money that comes out of your traditional IRA. So this kind of deflates the attractiveness of the backdoor Roth contribution if you have an existing traditional IRA that has deductible money that you have deducted waiting to pay taxes on it later. He says he doesn't have any of that. So that's the cleanest scenario where you can put in money into your traditional IRA up to the contribution limit for the year and not deduct it, and then have the entire amount converted tax-free. It wasn't initially tax-free, of course, but no additional taxes into the Roth IRA. No problem. Don't have to worry about the pro rata rule. As soon as you have mixed monies in your traditional IRA, this becomes sometimes so deflated that it's not attractive to do this at all. But there's also some techniques we can use in certain people's cases to clean up their IRA, to have it not have any of this deductible money in it. That's probably beyond the scope of this particular conversation, but just know it is out there. There is a possibility of cleaning your IRA so that it can be nice and open for these Roth backdoor contributions. So he's set up pretty well for this. I think he's got a nice, clean, open traditional IRA. A reminder, you cannot set up multiple IRAs and then think you're going to avoid the pro rata rule, because the IRS sees all of your traditional IRAs as one big old IRA, even if you've got one at one custodian, another one at another one, completely different companies. That's, to the IRS, one big IRA. So you can't avoid this pro rata situation by simply moving money around. You have to empty the IRA of the deductible contributions one way or another before you can have a clean slate for these backdoor Roth contributions.
Excellent.
That felt like you answering, just because of so many words involved.
That was a long one.
That was a little strenuous for me.
Yeah, I would imagine. You got to learn to be pithy, like yours truly.
Mm-hmm. Just cut to the chase.
That's what I do. It's my middle name.
10 words or less.
Jim, cut to the chase, Sonier. Okay, this is a non-Social Security. No, wait a minute. This is a Social Security question. Okay. Back to Social Security questions again from a Southerner. For the last question, another Southerner bordering the fine state of Kentucky, but not Kentucky, Tennessee.
Very nice.
Tennessee is to the south of Kentucky.
Yes.
Well, Kentucky is to the north of Tennessee.
On most maps, yes.
Whichever way you want to go. My husband is going to collect his full Social Security at age 66 and also claiming back 6 months. And I'll let you explain in a minute what's going on there.
I think we've answered this one.
Oh.
Just last week, actually, I'm pretty sure.
Really?
Yes. It's the one where they thought they could claim early and then have no penalty, ultimately.
Negative.
Okay, go ahead. It sounds eerily familiar.
Eerily familiar, but was that listener from the fine state of Tennessee?
I believe so.
Maybe there's two Tennesseans. My husband is going to collect his full Social Security, claiming back 6 months when he turns 66. I'll let you explain that in a minute. He will continue to work full-time for one more year. My question is this. He will also work part time after working full time for one more year. Thus, he will still be paying Social Security taxes. Will his Social Security payments go up as a result to what he is paying into Social Security in taxes? He has worked for over 35 years, and some of the years that will be calculated into his 35 years are very small. If in the next few years he earns more, will they use those to calculate his Social Security payment, and will they raise his Social Security? I don't think
Excellent.
You answered that one.
No, but it has a similar flaw at the beginning to the previous question. And that first flaw is an understanding of claiming retroactive benefits.
Exactly. They didn't wait long enough.
Right. So this is a... it's true that once you reach your full retirement age, you can file retroactively, which is essentially backdating your application. However, there's a limit on that to 6 months of benefits or back to your full retirement age, whichever is shorter. So once you reach 66, which appears in this particular case, that is their full retirement age, they cannot file retroactively. They could go in and file, and you can backdate your application slightly, but not back the six-month retroactive and claim it as a lump sum. If he waited till 66 and 6 months, he could go in and say, essentially the reason why this rule is here, so that you have up to 6 months to go in and say, oops, I forgot to file at my full retirement age I intended to. Can we backdate the application? And they would then process it as if you had filed 6 months prior, pay you the lump sum of those 6 months worth of benefits you missed out on, and continue your benefits as if you had claimed the 6 months prior. You can't have it both ways. For them, if they want to file at their full retirement age, there's no reason to wait 6 months and then retroactively claim. They would get no money. They wouldn't be ahead anything. They're just going to make you whole. They're going to pay you the money they would have paid you anyway. So if their intent is to file at full retirement age, they should just go in and file at full retirement age. There's going to be no opportunity under their description to file retroactively. That's the first issue. Second issue, he can absolutely continue to work full-time after filing. Since he will have reached his full retirement age, there's no penalty for a reduction of benefits because of the earnings test. He's not affected by the earnings test since he will have reached his full retirement age. The only issue to consider working and claiming is any potential tax issues here. A tax issue meaning you might be paying taxes on your Social Security benefits, where if you weren't working, you wouldn't be paying as much taxes on your Social Security benefits. Don't know the specifics of their case, so I can't point that out. But I always like to, or I can't calculate it for them, but I like to point that out so people realize there's actually two ways working can harm your Social Security. One is because of the earnings test. The other is because of the change in your tax situation because of the simultaneous claiming of Social Security benefits and having taxable income. So he can do that. He can also then switch to part-time. And then the last question was, how is this work after he claims going to affect his benefits, particularly when he has his best 35 years contain some low figures or even maybe zero numbers? Well, the good news is, once you reach age 62, any work after 62 that you do can increase your benefits, but cannot decrease your benefits. So this kind of calms people who are worried about working part-time or not working at all after they reach 62, how that might harm their benefits. Once you have established the main calculation for your benefit happens when you reach 62, they set that then as much in stone as you can imagine it for Social Security. It will never go down from there. In the future, any earnings that you record, if they are substantial enough to replace an earlier year in your 35 best years, such that it will increase your benefit, they'll give you credit of those. Any earnings that would be placed in there and reduce your benefit, they won't do that. So I always like to say that any work after age 62 can help your benefit, increase it, but will not harm it. Nothing you can do choosing to work or not will reduce your benefit once they've calculated it when you reach 62. So for him, it sounds like if he continues working full-time for a year, that very likely might replace one of his earlier low years. And maybe those part-time years, if his earnings are substantial enough, he will replace some very low earnings years in his 35-year record. They'll see your earnings every year, recalculate your benefit, and give you an increase not due to COLA, right, which happens for everyone, but any COLA adjustment plus any adjustment for a recalculation of your benefits due to this new earnings that came out. So, yes, he might. Now, the frustrating thing for a lot of people is they'll work part-time, have Social Security taxes withheld, but see no increase in their Social Security benefits. That absolutely can happen.
Absolutely.
It happens to a lot of people, actually, especially when they're working part-time. They don't earn enough to replace an earlier year in the calculation, but yet they're paying more in Social Security taxes. Well, that's just how it works.
Sounds here in this case, though, he might have some very low earnings
right.
years.
So in this case, I think the potential is great. It will help the more years he works, whether it's full-time or part-time. For other people, it's just the way – think of it the same as years other than the 35. You might have worked for 40, 45 years in total. All those Social Security taxes that you paid in those other 10, 15 years outside of your 35 best do not contribute to increasing your Social Security benefit one iota, yet you paid Social Security taxes on all those earnings too. Just because you're retired, just because you're collecting Social Security late in life, that rule still applies. It's nothing against you personally. It's no special penalty for you being retired or someone in their 60s or 70s being penalized. It's no different than the 22-year-old who didn't earn very much, yet paid Social Security taxes in, but that year doesn't get factored into their benefit calculation whatsoever because it's low. It's the same effect. So mm-hmm. It's everyone's treated in this regard the same top to bottom.
Excellent.
So that's probably about it.
I think we answered that question quite adequately. We got through six.
That seems to be the sweet number.
If we can do
six per week, I think we might make at least not fall further behind.
That'll be 24 a month, maybe 30.
Which we're getting about that every month, aren't we? So yeah, we're not going to make a lot of headway.
But we do want our listeners to know, especially our iTunians, this is the Q&A version of the Retirement and IRA Show. We also have the EDU version. Look for that on or about every Wednesday. Look for the Q&A show on or about every Saturday on iTunes and Google Play. And, of course, for all our iTunians and Googleans, we want people to know we are living, breathing, practicing financial planners. Even though we are based in the state of Colorado, we can work with people throughout the United States. We have a very unique business model. You don't have to have us manage any of your assets. Don't worry about that. That's not what we do. We are true planners. And you can hire us to help you as you see fit. Some people hire us mostly for their retirement planning. We are what we call distribution planners. We are not accumulation planners. We understand retirement planning. We understand Social Security, IRAs, required minimum distributions. What was the other? Taxation mm-hmm. of all these benefits. So if you have any questions on your retirement, if you have any questions about any of the topics discussed on this show, and you would like to counsel with us, we offer what we call a coffee and a second opinion. And you can schedule that yourself right on our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Go right there, and on the home page, pretty much in the upper left-hand part of the page, you're going to see a little cartoon that you can watch. And right below the cartoon, a little button that says schedule your phone call or meeting here. And you're going to click that and schedule a coffee and a second opinion phone call. And if you're in the fine state of Colorado, you can meet with us in our Fort Collins, Loveland, or Boulder offices.
Perfect. So thanks, everybody, for joining us again. If you'd like to be live on the show and have an interactive experience with us, don't hesitate to set up that call ahead of time, 970-530-0556, just as a quick heads up. So we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning, They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.